5005, RD Dynamics Corporation, based in the United States. Mr. Welch, you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bill Welch for the plaintiff appellant, RD Dynamics. May it please the Court. The case arises from a bid protest at the Court of Federal Claims that was heard by Judge Hewitt, challenging the Army's decision not to award a Small Business Innovation Research Phase 2 contract, or an SBIR contract, to our client, R&D Dynamics.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, you say procurement should be defined as the acquisition of goods or services. And in this case, the government is acquiring research services. Therefore, this falls squarely within the definition. Is that right?
That's certainly correct, Your Honor. But also, it's not just research services. If you look specifically at the, especially the Phase 1 contract that's in the record, and there's no Phase 2 contract issued, it makes it very clear that there are at least three things that are being acquired. If you look at the contract specifically, it says... At Appendix 229, at the contract line items of the Phase 1 contract. The contract line item number 0001, or CLIN number 1, says that the contractor shall perform research on foil face seals for advanced gas turbine engines. It specifically identifies a quantity of 609 hours of research that's being acquired for a total price of $65,684. The acquisition of the quantity of hours, I think, couldn't be clearer that this is an acquisition of research services in this case. But if you look also at CLIN number 2, contract line item number 2, it identifies a specific deliverable. The contractor shall prepare and distribute a final report in accordance with Section C, Statement of Work. CLIN number 2 identifies
where
a quantity...
Is that? I'm sorry. Well,
this
oh,
is,
final
I'm report. Sorry, this
next
is the next page.
Got it.
Next page. 230, top of the page.
What is the... I'm trying to understand how this would work in practice. The theory is then that the Court of Federal Claims was required to review all of the proposals, those that were granted and those that were not, and regrade them and decide that your client was incorrectly graded, and is that the only relief?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor at all. What specifically we asked the court to do in the merits of the case was to look at two acts, and this relates to the standing issue, two acts that the evaluators took that specifically pushed us out of the what's called the funding band, which was this group of 19 proposals that were eventually funded. And those two acts were the act of the technical area chief making a different score than the initial technical evaluation, and also putting into the funding band a proposal that was scored lower than our clients. And if the court finds that those two actions...
But it's because they didn't... Isn't it because they determined that the other proposal was for something for which the Army had a greater need?
But that would be possible if the record was totally void as to the reason why.
But is that something... Exactly. Is the point that the reviewing court would then be obliged to review the proposals that were granted?
No, Your Honor.
As well, to determine the relative merits of this one?
I don't believe so, because if there is no stated reason why a lower scored proposal is in the funding band, then that in and of itself would be arbitrary and capricious. And what the court could do would then be to remand it to the agency for either a reevaluation or for a determination that R&D's proposal should have would be funded. So the court would not have to look at all the other proposals. Or all the other contract awards. It would just have to be able to identify specific acts that would have otherwise entitled R&D to be in that funding band.
So this kind of review would exist for sort of only really egregious cases and you recognize that it would likely be under an arbitrary and capricious standard given the highly discretionary nature of the entire program.
Absolutely. There's no question about that, and that's an issue that we always deal with in protest.
This is sort of like for the case where somebody says, you know, if you go out on a date with me, I'll fund you, and if not, I won't. And something that really
well, actually, that it's sort of like, you know, in the employment world, you say you can fire anybody for any reason except the wrong reasons. I mean, except those reasons that are considered illegal. In that case, in your case, that, you know, that situation might be illegal. But yeah, if it's something that is that a court would construe to be as a reasonable determination that a technical evaluator can make, and the court will always defer to those reasons as being acceptable.
What?
In our case, there were no reasons.
But what? And you're saying one of the cases there was something in the must fund band had a lower raw score than your proposal.
Yes,
but okay, say we kick that one out of the must fund band, you're still 21st, not 20th. You follow me? I mean, what?
Actually, if you kick that one out, we move from 21 to 20.
Right, but they only funded 19.
That's correct.
So the guy from 20. So how are you an interested party then? You didn't make it into the must fund band, even if you're right that they improperly put that one there.
That's correct. As I said, there, on the standing issue, there are two arbitrary and capricious acts that we have to demonstrate to get into that 19 funding band. The other arbitrary and capricious act was the technical area chief's disagreement with the initial technical scoring. And in fact, the initial technical scoring gave our client a nearly perfect score. Scores themselves are actually protected, but when the technical area chief then looked over that technical evaluation, he agreed with all the reasons that were stated as for strengths, and I think also weaknesses, but also for strengths, but he gave it a different score.
But isn't he totally entitled to do that?
He's
evaluating your proposal in comparison to other proposals, and this is not apples to apples. I mean,
right.
This is... Sort of
right.
Apples to camels,
right.
You know what I mean? Because it's not, the proposals can be on such totally wildly different areas. I mean, I looked in the appendix
yes.
at all the different subjects and topics.
Well, you're absolutely right. That I mean, there's a tremendous amount of discretion here, but there has to be a reason for the divergence. And we argue that the record was devoid of a reason.
But why does he have to give you a reason? He just subjectively decided that yours wasn't entitled to his highest score.
Well, Your Honor, I mean,
subjectivity
has its reasonable restraints. I mean, he can't, if it's what sometimes referred to as totally subjective, we also call that arbitrary. I mean, unless there's a reason for diverging from an existing evaluation.
I don't think that's right. I mean, in this case, the Army doesn't have to give any of this money out. They can give none at all. And another problem you have is even if you got into the top 19, how can you prove they still would have funded you? And I say that because maybe at that point they would have said, well, we're only funding 18 because, you know what, your proposal just isn't something that we want to spend the money on. Or suppose your proposal actually had a higher dollar value than the one that's going to get kicked out and there isn't enough money to fund it. It just seems you're pretty far from being able to establish your entitlement or even prospective entitlement, given the discretionary nature of all this. And again, the apples to camels approach is not so easy.
I do understand the issue, but I think what we have to do, I mean, we have to live with the determination that the Army made, which was to fund 19. And there's nothing in the record that specifically says we're going to fund these specific 19s because of 19 proposals because of the content.
Almost certainly require they have an amount of money they can spend, like any agency, right? And you agree that your proposal probably did not have the same dollar value on it that any other proposal they looked at had. Mm-hmm. Well, chances
yes.
are statistically highly unlikely. Well, they only have a pool of money.
Right.
So whether they can fund 19 sort of depends on how the dollars add up, right? I mean, if your proposal was cost a lot more than the other proposals, they can't necessarily, it's not one for one.
I understand that, but the record doesn't give us any indication other than the fact that they selected 19, and we argued that for standing purposes, which was the issue here, for standing purposes, which was one of the reasons why the court didn't reach the merits, for standing purposes, I think it's sufficient to argue that if we sort of kick ourselves or crawl up to the 19 level, then that at least puts us in the zone of consideration that would satisfy the standard.
I'm glad you brought me back on track, because one of the big problems I have with this case relates to what ought to amount to a procurement and what ought not to. And in particular, I'm struggling with whether this is a procurement like, can you build me 5 757 aircraft? Or is this a, we want to issue subsidies and grants to people who will do research on the human genome? Subsidies and grants clearly aren't a procurement.
I'd be glad to
agree. 5 757 clearly is. So where, because this is clear, so certainly in the middle between those two, and I'm trying to figure out which side is more like.
Certainly, I'd be glad to address that issue. And I think we covered that specifically in our reply brief, where we said that if you take this very narrow sense of procurement that the Court of Federal Claims took here, where they said there was no technical risk, a procurement has no technical risk, and this research project has significant technical risk, it's, therefore it's not a procurement. If you take that approach, then you end up almost, what you end, you end up, well, the way we put it in the reply brief, we said if the court adopts this narrow sense of procurement to determine the federal claimant's jurisdiction, the court cannot by definition, I mean the government cannot by definition procure research and development services. But the federal acquisitions regulations have a specific type of contract that's reserved for just exactly this arrangement. The federal acquisition regulations explicitly contemplates procurement of research and development services. Procurement here, research and development services, and mentions these services as a factor to consider. This is at Federal Acquisition Regulation 16.104, which is 48 CFR 104. And there it says, a firm fixed price, level of effort, term contract is suitable for investigation or study in a specific research and development area. The product of the contract is usually a report, which we have here, showing the results achieved through the application of the required level of effort. However, payment is based not on the effort, payment is based on the effort expended rather than on the results achieved. And that fits our contract here to a T. We have research.
Let's talk about the difference, because I'm having the same problem. If in fact they were seeking to procure phase two on the R&D for the development of this foil face seal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to face the issue that isn't quite what we're doing. That focuses it, and might very well put it within the bid protest, squarely within the bid protest language. Here the question is, which quite different project? Shall we fund this project, or shall we fund 19 other projects out of the 26 or the 30 that have asked for funding and that are in our area? And this is where I'm having the trouble with a practical sense of how you would resolve such a protest. Again, if it's all on the same technology and they say mine is better than his and this is why. But this is quite a different subject, which relates to a determination of need on the part of the Defense Department at the threshold. And suppose they say, we don't need these foils as much as we need the other 19, no matter how brilliant your solution to the problem is. Is that something that the courts are supposed to penetrate or authorized to penetrate?
The court would certainly, I would not expect the court to do that. I would expect the court to remand the matter to the Army to make that determination.
But they already made the determination as was being appealed.
Well, no, Your Honor, they didn't. I mean, we were
their rating system, that's rated in part as a contribution of need as well as technical quality.
Well, Your Honor, that's not exactly clear from the record. I mean, they funded their top 19 in this list, with one exception, and we don't really know why they put that one exception in there. So it was almost a mechanical determination that they decided how many dollars they had and how many proposals they would fund, so they would do that. Now, if, as Judge Moore mentions, they come back and say, well, we don't have enough money to cover R&D's full proposal, then you know, that's a risk we have to take. But that's not something we know about, and it's not something that's in the record.
Well, tell you what, Mr. Webb, let's hear from the other side.
Thank
you. We'll ask them at this time some of the same questions.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Lisa Sanchez for the United States. The appellant in this case has not identified any reversible error in the trial court's opinion. It also has not identified any violation of law, of statute.
I think that there's some ambiguity in the definition of procurement. We certainly haven't, at this point, issued a clear definition. The statute doesn't define it. A different statute defines it. And so what if the definition is the acquisition of goods or services? How does the government argue then that the acquisition of research services is not an acquisition of goods or services?
Because through the SBIR program, the government acquires nothing. The government funds concepts or ideas pursuant to a statute that specifically provides for
the government requires nothing, but the government is choosing and targeting sort of which areas of research they would like to have developed. And correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't the government get a royalty-free license to anything that is developed as a result of this funding?
Not necessarily. There's an option, but it is not an automatic royalty or license or any sharing.
They acquire rights. They acquire research in areas in which they're obviously interested, and at least looking at this phase one contract to which Mr. Welch developed this, it says award contract. It doesn't really on its face look like an approval of a research proposal.
The approval of the research proposal is in a separate document. The document that Mr. Welch refers as a contract
but that doesn't help you. In fact, if they award the contract, there we are, straight into the contract structure.
What is awarded is not a contract. What the agreement summarizes is how the funds are to be spent. The funds are to be spent in the research of the concept that.
It's not a contract. You're saying they call it a contract, but it's not a contract.
I'm sorry?
They call it a contract. It says contract.
They call it an award at the top, slash
it's
contract.
Award slash contract.
It is an award of discretionary funds to develop a concept, but it is not
signed by a contracting officer. It's got all the things of the contractor, who they call a contractor, not a researcher to do. It's got all the trappings. A contract.
We agree that some of the terminology used in the SBIR program is analogous to the terminology used under the FAR for a traditional competitive procurement. But we need to look beyond that because the SBIR program is mentioned nowhere in the FAR, and it is not a FAR-driven award program. It is driven by the SBIR implementing statute, which is found at 15 U.S.C. 638, and if we look at the purpose of that statute, it is to provide assistance to small businesses for them to prosper, if possible, with assistance from the government. But it is
and
not
by doing research in areas of interest to the government.
By developing concepts, yes, research concepts, and that may or may not lead to a product. The government expects nothing in return other than the funds be expended in the manner for which they are intended. But
so are you suggesting that no acquisition of research services could ever qualify as a procurement?
No, the government contracts through procurements under the FAR for research and development all the time. The problem is that the SBIR program is not part of that procurement under the FAR. There is no.
It's not specifically mentioned, but why isn't it? If the SBIR program is research services and the acquisition of research services why does it really mention it? Why does it matter that it isn't specifically mentioned in the FAR?
Because it's not a competitive procurement. It is outside the scope of...
Well, it certainly seems competitive. I mean, there's how many proposals? I don't know if I would...
In the context of this case, there was only one submission of a concept idea under the topic that this appellant submitted his idea. There was no competition.
Everyone else had a different idea.
Under different topics. Yeah. There were various topics. This was the only proposal.
Ms. Sanchez, let me ask you, what you've been discussing, what you were discussing with Judge Newman and what Mr. Welch pointed out, which I guess is at 228 of the appendix. This is the phase one document, correct?
That is the phase one document that dictated how, or that memorialized how the funds awarded during phase one were to be spent.
Now, I realize that the issue here is R&D is complaining about not getting the phase two arrangement, correct?
Yes.
Do we have the form of the phase two document in here?
None exists, Your Honor, because there's no solicitation for phase two. It is by invitation only. And unless there is an award of funds, of research funds, for the phase two project, there would be no
document. If there had been a phase two award, would the document be basically similar to, in terms of its general form, to what we have for 228?
My understanding is that there would have been some sort of agreement memorializing how the funds were to be spent. Whether it's identical to the one for phase one, I do not know.
Let me ask you this other question. The phase one document, as Judge Newman pointed out, it's captioned award or contract. And Mr. Welch argued that this was a procurement of research services. You agree that's his argument?
Yes.
And the Contract Disputes Act covers contracts for goods, services, or construction. Okay. You agree so far?
Yes.
Okay. My next question is this. Is this phase one document, and I'll use the word document to keep it neutral, but is this phase one document covered by the Contract Disputes Act? In other words, is there a contracting officer on it? Do you get claims submitted under it? In other words, is the Contract Disputes Act cover the phase one arrangement that R&D had?
I don't know that I've ever seen an opinion on that issue. I don't know that we have any legal guidance on that from the GAO or from the court of claims or this court. I don't know that it's been tested, so I don't know. But if the question...
Is there any regulation that says it's covered by the Contract Disputes Act?
I'm not aware of it.
It says it's not covered. It's really the question, because on its face, it's signed by the contracting officer.
There is a contracting officer. I mean, I guess if the question is that, whether if R&D Dynamics had used the funds awarded for the development of the seal for a luxury home somewhere instead of developing the idea that the government thought it was funding, whether the government had any recourse in a court of law.
If they didn't perform, that's a different issue, isn't it?
Yes. I think it's...
One of the things that I noticed is the government talks in general about the SBIR as though phase one, phase two, and phase three, for the purposes of the analysis that we're doing today, would all necessarily be subject to the same outcome, meaning it seems as though the government is saying phase one, not a procurement, phase two, not a procurement, phase three, not a procurement. Is that the government's position? Because I understood Judge Hewitt to sort of distinguish between phase three, because they had one previous case that actually involved phase three, and phase two, and come to the conclusion that at least what was going on with regard to phase two itself was too developmental in nature to amount to a contract for goods or services. What is the exact position of the government vis-a-vis the different phases?
I think this court has answered that question in the Night Vision Court already, where there was a ruling that there's no entitlement to funding for a Phase 3 SBIR.
Well, no entitlement to funding is different from no jurisdiction because it's not a procurement.
But it's the same concept. I do believe that the...
No, it seems to be Night Vision is on the merits, and this is a question of jurisdiction. Is it a procurement or not? Is it an acquisition for goods or services?
It is not an acquisition for goods or services as required by the Timber Act to invest this court with jurisdiction.
It's not. What's not? The entire SBIR program, meaning...
The entire SBIR program.
So the government's position is, even if this had been a Phase 3 award, which maybe I need a little help understanding the differences. I understand Phase 1 to be sort of more general. Go do research. The amount of money the Army gives is smaller, and what they have to say they're doing with it seems to be less specific. When you get to Phase 2, it seems to be the notion behind it is, and now we want you to take your idea and bring it to, if possible, a prototype. And then Phase 3 is, now, if you don't already have a project, you've got to build one of those, and let's make this a commercially marketable, usable product. Is that, I realize that's a really generalization, but is that pretty close to what it is?
That pretty much summarizes what the SBIR program is, but there is no, the level of discretion on the Army is so high that there is no...
How does that have to do with whether it's a procurement? The fact that the level of the discretion is really high doesn't answer the question of whether it's an acquisition of goods or services.
Because it's an invitation to apply for funding.
The government always has discretion, right? They put out an RFP, and they can choose based on what they get back not to fund anything, not to actually award any contract at all. So there's always discretion.
But in the context of the SBIR program, we need to look to the implementing statute and the purpose of the statute. The statute specifically says that the purpose is to provide discretionary funds to businesses, to small businesses, to develop the small businesses and their ability to compete in the economy, not to procure.
You make it sound extremely utilitarian, and I have no doubt part of it is. But it also says to use small business to meet federal research and development needs. That's not quite as utilitarian. It's more utilitarian, but focused, at least.
Well, that is where the government discretion comes in. An individual or a company can have a great idea, and the government would have no need for that idea, even if the proposal were excellent. So that is where the discretion
But doesn't
comes
that
in.
All go to the merits of the government's decision to fund, and not the question of jurisdiction? I felt like the government brief just didn't address this point. There's a difference between the merits and the jurisdiction.
I understand the terminology used by the government in the entire SBIR program can be misleading because it compares it to it's analogous to a FAR-driven procurement. But I do think that if we focus on what the purpose of the program is, and we focus on the implementing statute, and also the wording in the source selection plan, that it is clear that the government has stated to prospective applicants for funds that they're not procuring goods or services.
Do you agree that Judge Hewitt, I guess I don't see her as having adopted the government's position that it's making now a moral argument, which is SBIR is entirely off the market for as far as procurement goes. I really took away from her opinion the distinction between Phase 2 in this case and possibly Phase 1 or Phase 3 elsewhere. That she was not speaking necessarily to Phase 3, for example, but at least the Phase 2 was too developmental in nature and therefore not a procurement in this instance.
The government doesn't fund the Phase 3 component of the SBIR program. The government simply, it's a requirement that the funding be from a private industry partner. So there is no...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes, so there would be no...
No basis for a Phase 3 bid protest.
Not that I'm aware of,
yeah. That's very interesting.
At least under the statute. But let's just say the facts aren't that remote, that this contractor did have a higher rating than others who were nonetheless included in the 19. So your position is that that's irrelevant. It just doesn't matter. It's totally discretionary. Suppose this contractor was rated at 100 and the several grants were issued in the 80s.
If the technical evaluation team gave it a perfect score, and then the technical area chief, through its own independent evaluation, because it wasn't a lowering of the score, it was an independent evaluation where the technical area chief came up with a lower score based on the needs of the Army and the interest of the Army in the project.
You're saying there is a component of need. If the technical evaluation was perfect, they said we really don't need these foils.
That is correct, yes.
So, but then would it still have a perfect evaluation?
It wouldn't have a perfect evaluation in the discretionary component for the banding into the different funding areas, because it would be lower, it would be scored lower, as happened in this case.
So you're saying that there is a need component in the total evaluation?
There is always a need component in the phase one, phase two SBIR program, yes.
Okay.
And if in fact, just to complete, make sure I understand, so there is a need component, and if in fact, because we are told that one of the 19 did have a lower overall total score than this petition.
That is correct, and the technical area chief in his own independent evaluation determined that the government's need in that area of research was higher, so it received a higher score. But that is the discretionary nature of the program.
And as a matter of jurisdiction, no one can complain if overall others with lower total scores receive the award.
We believe that is the case, because there's been no allegation of a violation of a regulation or a statute or any policy or procedure or process.
We're talking about jurisdiction, the right to complain, not whether your complaint would succeed.
That is true, but the complaint can't just be, I wanted funding, give me funding. And that is basically the essence of the complaint in this case. The complaint is, I believe my idea is excellent. I disagree with the Army's assessment that it's not as great. I think that the Army was wrong in its assessment. I think the Army needs this. Well, the Army said that it didn't.
But the routine bid protest, those are exactly the issues that are considered, and jurisdiction is not a question.
Well, in the bid protests that I've handled personally, there's always been an allegation of at least a violation of statute, regulation, or an arbitrary or capricious action.
I guess I'm a little bit bewildered. This seems to be a totally new argument right now, because the statute clearly calls for any alleged violation of statute or regulation in connection with objecting to a solicitation by a federal agency for bids or proposals for proposed contract or proposed award. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading from 1491B1. And so it does seem that a component of jurisdiction has to do with an alleged violation of statute or regulation in connection with procurement. And I guess I don't appreciate that that's what the lower court decided it on, and I don't feel that that's really what was conveyed in the government briefs, and we've got less, you know, we're already into the negative time. So I'm just wondering, while you may not at all be wrong, it's a little bit late. Or is it? Maybe it was raised somewhere and addressed somewhere and I just missed it.
A violation of law or statute?
Right. Statute.
There has been no violation.
I'm just wondering, has the government argued that jurisdiction is deficient because of the absence of a violation of statute or regulation?
I believe that I did in our brief, in the response brief.
I just have one quick question. The people who prevailed, and for the 19 people who were selected for phase two after phase one, they got a grant of money, correct? And what they had to do with that money was come up with a prototype, right?
Not necessarily the prototype. You mean for fund two? For phase two?
Phase two, yeah.
Yes, to a certain degree they had to come up with some. some sort of product, some sort of workable prototype on their concepts.
Okay. What if at the end of phase two, one of the phase one awardees, one of the 19, did not present anything to the government? In other words, just, you know, it got whatever amount of money it got, say it was $100,000, and at the end of the period, it presented nothing. It didn't present a report. It didn't present a prototype. It didn't do anything. What would happen then? What would the government's options be?
The Army would be entitled to inquire as to why there's no responsiveness. There's a monitoring component that goes along with the awarded funds. So at some point, if there's
I see. During phase two, a phase two awardee is sort of, there's someone who's kind of checking and seeing what's going on with the production of the prototype or the report or whatever it has to be produced.
Yes. I mean, that is correct. There are times that the concept goes nowhere and it fizzles in the middle. And that's just part of the, you know, part of the process.
Are there any regulations which set forth the procedures and the way these things operate? In other words, I know there's been reference to the federal acquisition regulations, but are there any particular regulations which govern this process, phase one, phase two?
Beyond the source, beyond the documents in the appendix and the implementing statute for the SBIR program, I'm not aware of any regulations that govern the disbursement of the funds.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Sanchez.
Not exactly sure. I intended to reserve. I'm not sure if I did or not.
Well,
we're
going to hear what you have to say.
Maybe just a couple minutes, if I could. I just wanted to address a couple of questions. Actually, just to take Judge Shaw's question very quickly, if a contractor doesn't perform under phase one or phase two, the government has a right under the contract. But phase two is not as clear because we don't have a phase two contract. But certainly phase one is very clear. If you look at appendix 244, you'll see it's a long list of FAR clauses incorporated by reference, and one of which address your question, has the standard default clause. So if the contractor doesn't perform, the contracting officer terminates them for default. To address Judge Newman's question about whether this is governed by the Contract Disputes Act, you look at the same page, 244, next to the last FAR clause incorporated by reference is the Disputes Clause. And the disputes clause, if I recall correctly, has a specific reference to the Contract Disputes Act. So I think it's very clear, and again, this is a phase one contract. We don't have a phase two contract.
I'm sorry, I missed that. What has the specific reference to the CDA?
If you, my memory is correct, but I believe it is. The disputes clause is referenced at the bottom of 244. The disputes clause, which is 52.233-1. If there's no specific reference to the Act, then its terms are at least defined by the Act.
Is there anything, Mr. Watson, in the record that would indicate whether in form a phase two document, and I'm using the term document so I don't side with either you or Ms. Sanchez on this issue.
Understand.
That a phase two document would be similar to a phase one document?
The only thing, and this actually addresses the point that Ms. Sanchez raised, which was there's no solicitation for a phase two here, which is not true. And I think in response to your question, Your Honor, we've seen the form of a phase one contract.
And we have that.
Right, we have that in our and the solicitation for phase one and phase two are in the same document, which is the document that begins at page 64. If you look at the table of contents on 65, you'll see that that the description for the procedures for proposals and awards are very, very similar for phase one and phase two. Ms. Sanchez is correct that you can't go to phase two unless you're invited, but the procedures for applying for and being evaluated on and receiving an award contract are in this solicitation.
So you're suggesting that if R&D had been a Phase 2 party, its Phase 2 document would have been similar to the one that we have in the record for Phase 1.
Exactly. And again, if you look at page, I believe it's page 2. If you look at, in the solicitation, it gives you, in the SBIR solicitation, there's a long list. I think it's in the contracting sections, page 18. There's a long list, yeah, here it is, page 84, excuse me.
84?
84. This is in the SBIR solicitation. Contractor commitments. It begins on the bottom of 83, section 5.11. It says, upon award of a contract, contractor will be required to make certain legal commitments, i.e. contracts, through the acceptance of government contract clauses. And then there's a long list, A through P, again, the standard terminology of FAR clauses. And even though it mentions only phase one here, it's certainly reasonable to expect that these same commitments would apply to phase two as well. The solicitation is not very, it's not crystal clear on this, but I think read together, I think it is very clear. Thank you for the extra additional time.
Any questions? Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Welch and Ms. Sanchez.
Thank you.
Thank you, and very nice.